Right. So thank you. So yes, I just wanted to talk to you about it's a recent work that we did with Julio just a couple of years ago, and basically our idea was to characterize somehow the variant content of the darkest halo that you can imagine, right? So the halo that don't have any stars. And let me put things in context from the beginning, so that everybody understand what we are saying here. And basically, you know, right? So from basically, there are observational evidence, for example, from the CMB, that the universe basically is the components of the universe are basically three, right? So it's dark matter, baryons, and dark energy, right? So and the fractions are basically, let me use the blackboard because we should use the blackboard. So right, so the dark matter, what we learned from the CMB is that the dark matter, doesn't matter what type of dark matter, right? But we see in the CMB, we see something that gravitates and accounts for roughly 24% of the budget of the total density of the universe. And then we have something, the baryons, the normal matter that we see, stars, atoms, everything, accounts only for 4%. So let me put this number to 6 then. And then the dark energy, right? The dark energy, which we don't know what it is. We don't know what is dark matter either, but anyway, so this is roughly like 70%, right? So you see all the complicated stuff that we know in the universe happens roughly here, right? In the 4% that we see here. So all the gas from there, the atoms interact there, so we have cooling, we have heating, we have all the possible interaction that we know about nature happening in only that 4% of the universe. So there remains 30% of the universe, or 65% of the universe, or and even the dark energy is something that basically we understand the effect very well. Dark matter gravitates, doesn't interact with photons, and dark energy basically pushes things apart, right? So it's very easy to simulate. That's a good thing of this whole picture, right? Because basically the universe is dominated by something that gravitates, that is very easy to describe, right? So we can basically run simulations. If we now start assuming different things for this dark matter, right? For example, if the dark matter is cold or the dark matter is warm, and we can start basically, if we don't care about what happened at the level of the particle itself, right? So basically, we as astronomers can model what happened with the dark matter just by modeling the power spectrum, the initial power spectrum of the initial perturbations, right? So if we know that, then people have done this for 30 years, more than 30 years now. Basically, what astronomers learn from there is just basically how the dark matter clusters in the universe, right? And people have constructed plots that look exactly like this, right? So we can count how many halos there are per unit volume in a cosmological simulation when the power spectrum is set. And then we can basically plot something, the abundance of halos, let's say, abundance, as function of the mass of the object, right? And then we find something that looks like this, right? So basically, there are few objects of very high masses. There are many, many objects of low masses. And then basically, if we start playing with the different flavors of dark matter, so if we say the dark matter is cold, basically we predict something like this. If the dark matter is warm, then we should see some cutoff at some particular mass scale. But basically, the picture is the same. We can always simulate that, and we can give essentially very strong predictions. Right? So once the CMB is set, but once we measure things in the CMB, we know there is this amount of dark matter. We put that in simulation. We assume something for the initial power spectrum, and then this is what comes out from the simulation. And this is a strong prediction. There's nothing to do about that. Right? This is what you simulate. This is what you get. Now, what we can do now is just compare with observations. Right? So this is our model. This is our cosmological model. Now we need to observe galaxies and see how this picture behaves in the galaxy, right? So people have done that in the past, and people are still doing that, right? So measuring with more and more accuracy what is the mass function of galaxies. But if you plot the same thing, now instead of plotting the abundances of halos, you plot the abundances of galaxies, you see something that looks like this, right? Let me just scale things. So basically, I'm assuming that I'm moving this curve to the left so that I can put them in similar scales, right? So I'm basically shifting this curve to the left, assuming some mass to light ratio, constant mass to light ratio for all the halos, right? So basically, we learned something very important here. Basically, if we now do the same exercise as in simulation, that is just counting the number of halos that we have and per unit volume, and we do the same in simulation, in observation in the real universe, this curve that you see here, basically we learn two things, right? That at any given mass, basically the abundances of dark matter halos or the abundances of galaxies, if we shift these curves, are basically the shapes of these curves are completely different, right? For a broad range of masses, right? Maybe they are similar in a very narrow range of masses, but here this function is much steeper than that, and here is flat, is much flatter than that, right? That means that there is, if galaxies actually forming dark matter halos, means that there is a sort of non-linear link between stellar masses and galaxies, right? What happened here is for other talk. What happened here is also part of another talk, but it's interesting what we can learn from this plot. From this plot, what we can say basically is that basically we assume something like, for example, small galaxies form small halos and big galaxies form big halos. We can rank the galaxies by mass. We can rank the halos by mass as well. And then we can basically do the exercise of matching by abundance, right? So basically we are here and we can say, oh, these galaxies of this halo mass, of this galaxy mass, what is the abundance that they have? It's this one, right? And then we can go to this curve here and read, oh, this is the abundance of dark matter halo that we have in the simulations, and then go down and we can read exactly what is the mass of the halo, right? That basically matched the abundance of galaxies at this mass scale. We can do that for different masses, and then we can basically solve this equation. Basically, we solve the abundances of galaxies with mass greater than something has to be the same abundance of dark matter halos with masses greater than this is mass of the halo, mass of something. So you can solve this equation numerically, and basically you get a relation that looks like this, right? So this is the mass of the galaxies as a function of the mass of the halo, right? And what you derive is something that looks like this, right? So this mass here is roughly 10 to the 10 solar masses, right? This is roughly 10 to the 10 solar masses in the stars. This corresponds roughly to, I don't know, 10 to the 12, something like that, slightly less than 10 to the 12, you see, right? Basically, what we learn here, we are saying exactly the same thing in a different manner, right? Basically, what we are saying here is, if we want to match the abundance of low mass galaxies to the abundance of dark matter halos that we have in cosmological simulation, then that automatically implies that there must be some very sharp cutoff in galaxy formation efficiency below some mass, right? What sets the slope of this curve here is physics, right? What sets the slope here is also physics, right? But what is important here is that there is a strong prediction, right? So if lambda c, if cold dark matter is correct and the numerical function is right, basically at some point, because we don't have enough galaxies in the universe, at some point halos should stop forming stars, right? And we learn all of that without knowing anything about physics, right? Just from measuring things in simulations and measuring things in observation, right? Now we should worry about physics, right? Why these things happen, right? So this gave rise to this is related to the problem, the different problem that people were discussing during this meeting, right? The missing satellite problems and things like that. Basically, we have too many halos in CDM simulations compared to galaxies, the galaxies we observe. So that means that some of them have to be dark. So we need to find some mechanism that make the halos dark. Or we prevent, or something that prevents galaxies from forming stars, halo from forming stars below some mass. So now, how we can determine how many variance basically gets accreted into dark matter halo? And I think that's important, a very important talk an important point of my talk. So basically, you know, maybe you all know that already basically the common belief is that basically, and there are observational evidence that support that, is that basically at high redshift, the universe underwent some phase transition, right? So the universe was all neutral because all the universe was very cold, the gas in the universe was very cold. Then that happened roughly at redshift 6, redshift 10, the first stars start to form, right? Even before that. and the photons from the first stars on the protogalaxy start to escape from them and then start to interact with the gas in the intergalactic medium. And that basically ionizes all the gas and also injects energy and heat up all the gas. At which temperature, basically, at the temperature of roughly 10 to the 4K, 10 to the 5K, at that very high redshift. And that's what we call reionization, right? So universe, we believe that universe is fully ionized by redshifts between 6 and redshift 10, right? That's basically, it's imposing a characteristic temperature to the gas, or if you want a characteristic pressure, right? So if that pressure is higher than the force exerted by the pressure is higher than the force that basically is given by the gravitational potential of Dark Matter Halo, then basically all the gas is going to expand at some point. And that's what we think basically is driving all the majority of this effect, this sharp cutoff that we see there, right? How we see that doing some calculations, right? So basically, So basically, we want to make a model, right, of how many baryons basically collapse to form a halo. Let's assume that the gas for one moment. Let's assume that we have a gas that is isothermal, right? So if the gas is isothermal, it means that we can characterize the gas in the whole universe by some temperature or some sound speed, right? Let's set the sound speed of the universe to of the gas in the universe to CS, right? That's the typical sound speed. We don't know the number. And then we want to calculate what is the final profile of the gas of baryons that we have given an NFW halo. So that calculation can be done very easily. Basically, we need to solve the hydrostatic equilibrium equation. So how we do that? So this is the hydrostatic equilibrium equation. And let's assume two things, right? Assume no cooling. So assume that the gas basically doesn't cool. Assume that the baryons don't dominate. Baryons don't dominate the potential, basically that the potential is basically set by the Dark Matter Halo. The baryons don't do anything at the beginning. After all the baryons account only for 70% of the mass of the universe at a high ratio. Always. If those conditions are satisfied, basically what and assume that this and also assume spherical symmetry, right? This is another assumption. Spherical symmetry. Is this correct? Yes. Right? If that happens, basically the question that we need to solve is essentially this one. Right? And this is very simple. Now we know that dark matter halos basically live in are well described by NFW profiles, right? And there are characteristic quantities that basically tell us what is how the mass is distributed within halo. We know the characteristic mass of the halos. We know the virial mass of the halo. We know what is the typical size of the halo at 200. And we also know from the combination of these two, we know what is the V200 of the halo, right? It's basically GM200 divided by R200. Square root of that, right? These are characteristic quantities of the halo that basically are useful if we want to write these things in dimensionless, if we want to write the dimensionless equation. And also, we know what is the characteristic density of the gas in the universe at a given redshift. The characteristic density of the universe is basically the mean density of the universe, right? So we can define quantities, for example. This is useful to see. That's the reason I'm going to write things in this way, basically. You can define the mass of the halo, some dimensionless quantity, just like the mass of the halo divided by M200. Or we can define, for example, the radius of the halo as the radius divided by R200. These are dimensionless quantities. If you start doing these kind of things as they are, basically this equation that you see here basically can be written as something like this. Like basically 1 over rho. And let's assume, we assume isothermal gas, right? So we are characterized by the sound speed, basically. This is going to be C squared, d rho, dr. This is going to be minus P200 squared. Right? And this is a dimensionless equation to solve for hydrostatic equilibrium in a gas in an infinite background. Basically, what we're modeling here is basically, so we have an infinite universe. with density rho mean, but in this unit, our rho, the density is basically one everywhere. And then we are putting a perturbation here that has some mass profile. And the mass profile basically follows an NSW halo, right? The radius, basically this is R 200. In this unit, R 200 is going to be one. And that's it, right? Basically the equation that, we need to solve if it looks much better, it looks something like that. Right? It's minus V 200 divided by the sound speed squared divided by R squared. Right? And this is a completely dimensionless equation. In principle, valid for any halo. Basically, the only thing that we need to set, we know what is the mean density of the universe. The only thing, the only free parameter in this equation, basically, is the singular velocity and the sound speed, this ratio. Right? So this equation has a very simple solution. I'm not going to solve it, but you see, right? It's an exponential, it's some exponential thing. Basically, the solution, let me read it. The solution for this equation, and then it's interesting to see this equation because it tell us a lot about why basically baryons stop accreting gas at some point. That's the reason I'm writing this, right? So basically, the solution of this equation in dimensionless quantities, basically some exponential, basically it's V200 divided by sound speed squared. And then we need something, we need to do something, right? So we need to integrate this part. And this part, if we assume it's an NSW halo, the integral is analytic, and the integral basically looks like this. So there is some function that depends on the concentration of the halo, and then there is a log of 1 plus CR divided by R. And that's it. Basically, we know everything now, right? So if we know what is the temperature of the universe at high redshift, we know what is the super velocity of the halo, and we know what is the density profile of the halo, we know what is the density everywhere in the surrounding that perturbation, right? What we can learn from here, basically, that the density of any halo. Yes.
This is the density of the gas.
Baryons. Only the gas. Yes, it's the density that basically led to the pressure. Exactly. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So what we learn from here? This is one. This is the virial radius. This is the mean density of the universe, which is one. And this, if you plot this curve, it's going to look something like this. Right? So the virial at the central parts converts to some value that is basically the exponential something, depends on the concentration of the halo. But basically, imagine that the concentration was the same for all the halos, which is, we know is not the case, but imagine that. Basically, it tells us that the maximum density that the halo can reach in the inner part, basically, is related to the ratio between V200 and the sound speed of the gas. Further out, doesn't matter, right? Because further out, basically, we need to reach the mean density of the universe, right? So basically, converge to something.
When you calculate, you use M Tweedle. Mm-hmm. That's for dark matter, right? So yes. You don't include gas in there.
Exactly. If at some point this equation tells us that basically the density of the baryons is much greater than the density of the dark matter, then the approximation stops working, right? Of course, this approximation, they all look the same, right? So basically, what says basically, now this sound speed basically is the sound speed of the gas that collapses in the halos, right? So basically, it has to be related with the typical temperature of the gas within the dark matter halo. That was said, the pressure of the halo. Right? So you know that basically, if the halos are massive, so basically and the only source of energy in our system is the gravitational gravitation. Gravity. Basically, we are going to the temperature of our gas is going to be set only by that potential. That means that basically what one expects for a halo once it collapses is basically the sound speed is roughly the singular velocity of the halo, right? So this will happen, basically. Once the halo collapses and you measure what is the temperature of the gas in that halo, which was heated up by the collapse of the halo itself, basically you always heat up the gas roughly to a temperature which is given by the temperature of that potential that you have. That temperature is the virial temperature. Or, in other words, is the singular velocity of that halo. If that was the case, if basically the sound speed was set only by the gravitational collapse of the halos, then you see that basically this equation is so similar, right? Doesn't depend on halo. But it doesn't matter what is the halo mass that we have. So basically this would be the same for all the halos, But we know that that's not the case. We know from here that that's not the case, right? So B200 basically is in units, basically something that is roughly 30 kilometers per second times the mass of the halo divided by 10 to the 10 solar masses. And I think this is, what is the unit, what is the power there? It's one third, right? Yes. It's one third, right? The mass of the halo. We know that the high redshift, basically the universe was ionized. To ionize the universe, basically you need to inject as much energy as you need to ionize a hydrogen atom. So that basically, that roughly corresponds to heating up the gas to roughly 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, right? The sun speed, as a function of temperature, is roughly 10 kilometers per second times T divided by 10 to the 4 K, so the 1/2, right? So basically, if we heat up the gas at 10 to the 4, the sound speed of the gas in the universe is going to be 10 kilometers per second. Now, if we heat up the gas to 10 to the 5, it's going to be a factor of 3, larger than that, right? So it means that basically, ionization, what does is basically it's imposing a typical sound speed for the gas in the universe, which is roughly between 10 kilometers per second, 20 kilometers, 30 kilometers per second, let's say. Somewhere around there, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. What is the virial, what is the circular velocity of a halo of 10 to less than 10 to 10 solar masses? It's of the order of that, 30 kilometers per second, 10 kilometers per second, right? So that means that as we move to lower and lower and lower halo masses, at some point, the virial velocity of the circular velocity of, halo, of our halos is going to be always much more than the temperature of the gas in the universe. That means that basically all of the gas in the halos is going to be the temperature of the gas in the halo. It's no longer to be set by the gravitational collapse of the system. It's going to be set by something else, some external thing, right? By the radiation, but it's going to be set by the radiation coming from other energetic sources. And that would break the cell similarity that we see here, right? Of course, if we go to other regions where the halos are more massive, this equation doesn't work either. And the reason for that is basically you have cooling and all sorts of things, right? And this approximation is even no longer valid from the very beginning. Baryons always dominate, right? But you see, for very low mass galaxies, this approximation is almost perfect. It's almost perfect. So basically, what happened then? So if this ratio gets smaller and smaller and smaller, because basically this number is fixed, but this number goes down as we move to lower and lower and lower masses for halos, then we are going to see something that looks like this. Even in this normalized unit, this maximum that we get is going to go down. Mm-hmm. At some point, we are going to approach some constant curve here, which basically the gas everywhere in all the halos basically is at the mean density of the universe. Right? And that's where we say, oh, those halos were photoevaporated by the UV background, right? Or by ionization. And this is what we mean when we say, oh, halos below a given mass basically don't manage to form galaxies. That's because they didn't even manage to put baryons in them from the very beginning, right? Right. So we can do one calculation. Okay, we know more or less with this simple model, we know how to calculate the density profile of the dark matter halo, of the density profile of the baryons within dark matter halos of low mass. And then we can integrate this. So if we know the density, we can integrate that and get what is the gas mass that we have.
At which redshift does this happen, the evaporation?
Redshift between 6 and 10.
So this is when the reionization
exactly.
happens, the moment that reionization happens, some halos, do you know the size of those?
They had to be smaller than 10 to the 10, smaller than 10 to the 9.
So all those that are smaller than 10 to the 10 solar masses evaporated?
Mm-hmm. Oh, at that. Yeah, but you see, it's not like a sharp transition that you have a halo that is photoevaporated and a halo that is not photoevaporated, right? There's a transition in that regime, right? So basically, the density profile starts going down. How down? Depends on the ratio of the temperature of the universe and the circular velocity of the halo, right?
Oh, there's another problem. I mean, you basically effectively assumed here that the halo forms after ionization, whereas in reality, part of the halo, the progenitor of the halos, have formed before ionization, and therefore this does not apply at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You already have cooled quite a bit of gas before you hit the stage where photoevaporation comes effective.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. That's another point. Yes.
I see. So those are for the ones that form after. So if you have a lot of structure formation before that depends on, then those will stay as gravitationally bound.
Yeah, so that's some is called orphans. So whatever you form before reionization, your gas is very cold, and that could in principle create stars.
Yeah.
Typically, the depth of potential of a halo only goes deeper, right? So in principle, that still applies to some regime. So, but any redshift after ionization would be a mass below which you have forming stars, but still some gas. Right? Mm-hmm. So I guess that's what you're
going to do. Yeah, I'm going to show that.
Mm-hmm. So the regime between basically halos have low baryons and halos that have formed stars. That regime is just what is interesting.
So basically, if you know this, basically you can start integrating this and get what is the gas mass that you expect for each halo mass. Right? This is M200, log of M200, the gas mass of the halo, integrated, up to R200. Right? So you're going to see something like this. So basically, something like that, and there's a break, something like this. Right? Basically, I did this calculation last night just to put some numbers here. Basically, what we learned here, where the breaks come from, right? So basically, this mass correspond to using just this calculation and assuming a sound speed of 20 kilometers per second for the early universe, right? So this is 10 to the 8 solar masses, 10 to the 9 solar masses.
I was going to say, isn't your break going the opposite direction?
Sorry?
That's getting steeper, right? Low 10 to the 8.
Yeah.
You get less gas per unit halo mass.
No, less steep, right? Because here, what happened is that these halos have basically a constant density. They have a constant density, basically the density profile is constant. Basically, you are embedded in a constant density background, right? So basically, the gas mass is proportional to the mean density of the universe times R200 cube, which is proportional to M200. So it's a one-to-one relation. When you reach a lower masses and lower masses, basically that's the reason you have a break. Once your halos are more massive than that, basically you start putting more gas. The gas within the halos gets denser and denser and denser. So basically you start adding up more and more gas.
Is there another break then if you were to keep going to the right to higher and higher masses?
At some point, all the approximations break down. At some point, all the approximations break down and doesn't work, right? So you are pooling and things like that.
Oh, this is assuming one and the same temperature for the gas at all halo masses.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because even at 10 to the 9, we are still, this approximation is still correct, right? Because the virial mass of the virial temperature of the halo is still lower than 20 kilometers per second.
Say this again, assuming the same temperature for
all the gas, yes. That's valid because the virial temperature of the halos are always much smaller than the temperature of the universe at high redshift. So the halos cannot heat up the gas to more than what is set by the ionization. Right? That's the reason the approximation holds. Now, if you start decreasing the sound speed at high redshift, basically you can make this steeper. But this part never changes.
Uh-huh. That's very messy when it goes linear again.
That's more complicated. Mm-hmm. And that's it. So
this still needs to be shallower than 1:1.
This one is 1:1. Basically, you're integrating a constant density background.
Oh, you're...
Yeah, no, zero gas. So you're
way out. This is when it's flat.
It's here.
This one is flat.
Yes.
Oh, God, that's...
Okay. But that's an interesting quantity. Basically, if you wonder which are the halos that are actually photoevaporated with zero gas, these are below 10 to the 8 solar masses.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not zero gas, we just have
It's not bound. It's not bound. Basically, they are embedded in a uniform background of gas, right?
So if this is correct, you can use the amount of smaller halos that have a status as a test of how much a structure you had formed before recombination, before reionization.
Basically, yes. Basically, if you see a halo today that has some stars, then you know that was more massive than something at the reionization.
It was formed before.
Yes. Collapsed before that. Yes. Actually, this is roughly consistent with what we see in simulations. Right. So the important point is here. You see, we have a very simple model. So we know what is the shape of the halos. We know what is the conditions of the universe at very high redshift. We can derive. And we basically everything is very simple because we don't have transformation, we don't have feedback, we don't have cooling, we don't have anything. So that's the reason we managed to do this calculation. And now the question is, does it work? Right? And this is what I wanted to show you. Right. So what we did basically was we understood this. So I went to the simulations and then I say, what happened with the small halos, with the dark halos that don't have any stars in the simulation, right? Can we understand their properties? And basically, this is what I'm plotting here. So basically, this plot shows a lot of things, but basically, it's the same plot that we have here. It's the stellar mass, halo mass relation. This is the stellar mass of the galaxies as a function of gas mass of the galaxy as a function of stellar mass. Basically, I'm plotting two different quantities here in the same plot. So the blue line that you see here is for a for the simulation. What is the stellar mass that we have? The median stellar mass of the halos at this halo mass. The median stellar mass of the halos that of this halo mass. Right? This is what it is. Basically, you see again what I said before, right? So basically, there is a sharp cutoff in the star from in the stellar mass below 10 to 10 stellar masses in halo mass. Right? Again, this is understood by reionization. Right? Because in the simulation, basically, we include the effects of reionization. We heat up the gas suddenly at very high redshift. And that was basically driving this cutoff that you see there. Now, what happens if we select all the dark matter halos that didn't manage to form a galaxy, and we measure the amount of baryons that they have at redshift zero? These are the points, the red points. Right? Each red point that you see there is a dark halo that don't have any star. And we are plotting here the gas mass of the halo.
That's H1 gas, I guess.
Yeah, we don't simulate H1, it's just gas. It's just the internal of that.
Do you know what would be the column density models?
Yes, I'm going to that. Okay. Yes. Yeah, you can estimate other things after that.
Maybe all these data points are simulations, right?
All the data points are simulations here.
Okay.
With all the nonlinear collapse and so, right? So
for example, now that people have all these strange ways of cooling the gas, through dark matter interaction or axions or whatever, right? So if you cool the gas, it depends how much you cool, but you would tend to form more stars before all this happens. You know, this is for the edges, to trying to explain the edges line. So in some of them you will have many more, and some many more halos. So this could constitute actually a test of some of these extreme cooling mechanisms for the Or you can't. There are too many uncertainties.
I don't think so. That observing this, for example, observing this at low redshift is going to test that, because basically what's happening here is that basically the properties of the gas at this redshift is set by the current temperature of the universe. We need to know what is the outer pressure in the halos today, not at redshift 10.
Or 20.
I think we are not going to observe these things at redshift 10. We are not going to observe these things at redshift 10.
But didn't you tell me that if they are smaller, well, maybe I don't understand this very well. But you said that actually there is a sort of a cutoff present, but if you have many halos that actually have stars and are smaller, those would form before. And that would be sort of a test or a bound for extreme cooling at high redshift, or not, I'm not sure.
It would be a good test if we had a very good understanding of star formation of population 3 stars forming these first little halos. And that's still very uncertain.
So it cannot be united.
So if you cool the baryons a bit more via dark matter interactions, then
Actually, we don't.
Crystals haven't been detected yet. So if you detected them and they're very different from this prediction, I think it's fair to say that. So, in other words, if you find a halo that's no stars, no metals, and its density profile deviates very significantly from this, and its matter contents deviates very significantly from this, something else has happened beyond penetration. So that's, and if we could measure that, I think one could interpret it in terms, for example, of energy exchange between dark matter. But we haven't seen that. So this is the simplest prediction, if you want. So if you
and seem to, the observations seem to agree with this prediction. There are no.
We haven't observed this one.
Those haven't been detected yet. Mm-hmm. So this is what he's calling those relics. So this is a prediction of caudalic matter. And caudalic matter have described lots of low mass halos. Below a certain mass, you don't form any stars. The problem becomes very simple. There's no stars, no feedback, there's no metal enrichment, there's nothing. So it's very simple. Now you just have gas, you have some equilibrium in a potential world that in principle we know very well.
I see. So if you would have a small halos that you should predict the existence of, and then they would have some of them have stars, that would be some indication of very strong cooling.
I think the idea would be to find something that doesn't have stars, and whose matter content is very different from what this prediction.
Well, why is it that way? I think what she's trying to say is, say you find 10 to the 7 solar mass halos that have stars.
Right.
Oh, that's a challenge. That's a challenge, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's a challenge for the model.
But if you were to find halos that are very low mass, and have stars well below 10 to the 9.
That means that this approximation is already programmed, right? Basically, that means that all our mass function is wrong, right? Basically, we cannot match things by abundance. So what we're doing here is basically wrong, right? This is a strong prediction of CDM. If we see something here, a galaxy that lives there.
It's not only CDM, it's cooling, it's gas cooling.
Yeah, like it would indicate dark matter.
Like Frank was saying, we don't understand
the gas cooling.
The gas cooling, and so it's going to be very hard to distinguish between
any mechanism of gas.
Right, dark matter cooling or cooling, standard cooling.
But you need to have a lot of extra cooling to drive it towards star formation.
Yeah, I wonder because Kersicki is not here right now, but he has this mechanism with axions that actually seems to be extreme cooling. This is physically
But the edges have seen like two or three cooler that, but a little bit, that's not going to suddenly promote exosar formation because this system still works.
It doesn't.
But I'm still puzzled about, so in this simulation, and this is a simulation prediction, but I'm pretty sure that you've probably just put in reionization by hand at some point. You put in this sort of UV background that you had in.
Yeah.
But a UV background must come from something, must come from stars. Star formation must have happened.
Yeah, in other galaxies, in other.
Yeah, but I still think all these things, every halo has a main progenitor. And in your simulation, you're not necessarily resolving those main progenitors below a given redshift. And those main progenitors live at some point pre-reionization. When, we still don't really know how to properly model whatever goes on.
We can play with the numbers here. Basically, that would change basically what is the minimum halo mass that hosts a galaxy, right?
What do you call a galaxy, right?
With one star.
If I form two or three stars in there. That's a galaxy.
Basically, we could play with these numbers here. But basically, below that number, this prediction is still valid. So you need to go to lower masses. Basically, this halo would not exist. But that's all.
Right? At some point, you will. And I think that one of the cool things would be that mask where that start where these things starts to pop in. That's very sensitive to warm dark matter from CDM.
Also, for sensitive to how we deal with early star formation as
exactly,
well.
Exactly.
Yes, so I totally agree with you. Yes, I agree.
Okay. I think that the problem for warm dark matter on the rest is that this cutoff in cold dark matter happens at, say, close to 10 to the 10. The differences in mass function for most viable warm dark matter models starts to be seen at 10 to the 8. So that's why all the warm dark matter models and cold dark matter models with galaxies, they all look the same, because the changes are in mass scales which are below the scales in which you form any galaxy that is luminous. in contact matter. So I think that he's talking about a different regime. Regardless of the details here, if there is a sharp cutoff in the efficiency of galaxy formation, there must be a regime of low mass halos where there's only gas. The gas is at a certain equilibrium and has no metals, and the problem is actually quite simple. Mm-hmm. That's what he's trying to get at.
So where on this plot do you get to the point though where there's no enhancement in density relative to the background? That's a
so we don't reach that point. Those halos are under the resolution limit, right? So this is 10 to the 8, and this is just that.
So basically, there's like something like an order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude in halo mass where there's just gas but no stars.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So I don't understand what you replied to, because Frank had this point that, you know, those could have accreted smaller halos that were formed before ionization, and therefore they will bring stars. You don't see them because of resolution. So what was the solution to that?
No, basically we can be sure that basically there are no galaxies more luminous than, if you want, 10 to the 4 solar masses. There are no more masses than 10 to the 4 solar masses. That's the resolution limit. If there is no, basically these are the halos. Basically we call them a starless halo. It basically didn't manage to form 10 to the 4 solar masses. Right? That's what we can say.
This is the final result, right? So if you had a galaxy, a halo of formed stars, at any time in their history, today it has a mass that's more than 10 to the 10th. So it doesn't matter what it formed, would it have 10 to the 8, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 5. Today it has more than 10 to the 10. That's the way this is expressed in today's units.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I don't still understand.
That's a prediction of that model, and what
you're
arguing
is
of this simulation. And it's not clear that if you would have much higher resolution, and the simulations.
What about it? Yeah, but I think it still be something similar. Maybe change quantitatively a few, but the fact that you cannot populate all halos with them 8 to the 10 to the 8 to the 10 with luminous galaxies as luminous as 10 to the 3 and 4, I think, stacked. So there must be halos that are basically dark. Mm-hmm. Those halos that are dark, never formed any stars. Whether quantitative is as sharp as is shown there or not, that's a different question. But still, if you want to put stars there, it puts as 1 in 10,000 halos. So it doesn't matter, right? For that.
But you do agree that you are not going to form a galaxy in a halo 10 to the 9, so
I
don't agree?
I can easily imagine that at some point a progenitor was 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 solar masses at redshift 12, and it formed a little bit of, you formed a star, 1.3 star.
One?
Yeah, well,
okay.
According to your definition, that was a galaxy. So I'm not convinced that it's back to 0 by 10 to the 9. I'm not even convinced it's back to 0 by 10 to the 8. I agree that it will drop like a rock, and you're going to see those things then, nevertheless, but
Okay,
that's general.
I think you all agree on the qualitative side. It's just that basically this is model dependent. That's all the front is saying.
Okay.
Really, like the qualitative aspect, I think everybody's agreeing on.
Okay, let me just point out another very interesting aspect of this plot. You see all the below. Let's not argue for that. Okay, we can change these numbers, right? But below a given mass, basically, it's not that all the halos have gas following this relation that you see here. Basically, we have, there are basically two flavors of halos. The ones that have gas, basically are in this very narrow region that you see there, following that relation. And there are halos that don't have gas, right? And many of them have zero gas particles within them. Those are those, right? So basically, this model doesn't work, right? Basically, works for the ones that have gas. But basically, the simulation is telling us that there is a huge population of galaxies, even more than this than those, that actually don't have gas at all. So somewhere in the model phase, right, in the simulation. And what happened? Basically, this is what happened, right? So basically, if we plot the distribution of the dark halos that have gas, and these are the ones that have gas, and this is the one that don't have gas. Basically, this is an edge-on projection of the local group. Basically, this is the gas distribution. Here you see gas, here you see the dark matter distribution, and here you see the position of the two main galaxies of the local group, like Milky Way and M31. Basically, you see there is a big filament of gas in that simulation, right? So where that contains most of the matter that collapses to form the local group. These are the two main galaxies, right? So the galaxies that have gas, the dark halo that have gas, basically, they all live in the outskirts of this big filament. roughly in a spherical region. The ones that don't have gas basically are living in the filament. Right? Sounds counterintuitive because you see most of the gas in the filament. Why the ones that are in the filament don't have gas? Right? Sounds counterintuitive, but it's actually very easy to understand what's going on. And basically, this is what's going on, right? So here I'm following as a function of time from very high redshift before reionization. You see after reionization and two more times, basically. This is reionization, and this is today. So this is Big Bang, just further out there. And here, this is current time. Basically, what we're following here is we are tracking basically one individual halo. And we are basically measuring here the gas mass enclosed within the virial radius of the halo, or the dark matter mass. And this is the evolution of the virial temperature of the halo. Right? And this is the gas, the baryon fraction, basically the gas mass divided by the dark matter mass. Basically, you see, after reionization happens, by redshift 6, this is baryon fraction, the galaxy still accretes some gas, right? The reionization happens here. The gas still goes into the galaxy, but at much lower rate than the dark matter. So basically, what happens is that the halo accretes more dark matter than gas, and the baryon fraction goes down. Just because, basically, the pressure of the gas is slowed down, the accretion of baryon, right? The gas is too hot for this halo. The temperature of the universe is roughly 10 to the 4, but the virial temperature of this halo at that time is roughly 10 to the 3. Right? That's the reason basically stop accreting gas. And then at much later times, basically this halo encounters a big filament. The big filament that we see we saw in the previous picture, this big filament that we see there, which is overdense. And the rotating velocity between the two is very high as well. So remember, the typical singular velocity of this halo is of the order of 20 km per second. The typical velocity of the collapse to that filament is higher than 150, 200 km per second. Basically, that's a very good condition for run pressure stripping to do something to remove all the gas from the halo. And basically, this is what we see, right? So once we pass through the filament, basically, we see the gas tail just behind the object, right? So this guy is moving downwards. Basically, and this is what happened, right? So you see the baryon fraction basically drops to zero after the interaction.
So when you say zero, you mean zero? What do you mean? Because the ramp pressure stripping should never bring it to zero. It should bring it to the average density of the filament.
Yeah. No, the bound gas. No, okay. No,
oh,
okay.
Bound.
You're right. Bound gas. Okay. Bound gas. Basically, I'm subtracting this background. Mm-hmm. Yes, you're right. Basically, if you want to see the thing in action, I have a movie. Basically, here you are going to see the density. The colors correspond to the density, the projected density, and this is the temperature. And this is the formation of one of these halos that don't have any gas. Right? So basically, the camera is always following the guy that forms here. It's very boring, right? So you're not going to see any formation of gas or anything like that. But you see, it's a very round thing, approaches to the filament, and that's it. Right? So they are not very bound. So that's the reason they are very easy to strip. So this is a typical evolution of one of the halos that basically follow this model, this simple model. Basically, you see the only difference here is that there is no any filament. Basically, the halo is very boring. Nothing happens. The halo forms, reionization happens, the baryon fraction goes down, but then remains roughly constant. Mm-hmm. And basically, at the end, we see a spherical gaseous halo, pretty nice, right? Which is is pretty consistent with all the assumptions of our model, and the reason everything works, right? But I have a caveat here, and I'm not going to enter into much details here, but basically we assume basically the temperature of the gas is set by the constant sound speed, right? So by the temperature of the universe. What happened in reality in these halos is that basically you know that, right? So if the density within the halo is higher than something, collisions start to become important in the halos, and the halos can cool. The gas can cool, right? By interaction of pairs. That means that the cooling rate basically is proportional to rho squared, because we need collisions, right? Have to be proportional to rho squared. We know that basically the same radiation field that ionizes the universe basically is injecting heat to the gas. And that heat, the injection of heat, basically is proportional to the density, right? Because it depends on how many photons we have and how many receivers of photons there are. Right, so that's the reason it depends on density. So that's the reason, naively, we expect that, well, not naively, we expect that basically at high densities, we are dominated by cooling because that goes as rho squared, and low density, we are dominated by heating because it goes like rho. And that's in principle a very characteristic shape to the gas, that basically this is the temperature and this is the density of the gas that is bound to these halos, to this kind of objects. Because we have cooling, but we have heating here, and the cooling rate of the gas is shorter than the age of the universe, but the heating rate is also much shorter than the age of the universe. Basically, we reach some kind of equilibrium here, where the photoheating balances the cooling rate of the gas. That's why all the gas basically sit down here. At lower densities, basically the cooling rate, the cooling time scale of the gas is much longer than the Hubble time. Basically, it doesn't matter if we have two Hubble times or five Hubble times in the universe, the gas is not going to cool, never. But the heating time is not, right? So the heating time is equal to the age of the universe, just on this line here. Basically, if we put all the gas at very low temperature here, and then we wait for a Hubble time, then the photoheating, the background, the radiation that comes from stars, is going to heat up all the gas to this particular shape that we see here there. And this is what imprints this particular relation between the temperature and the density, right? So if we know this curve, which we know from the simulation or from the cooling tables, then we can, and basically that means that we know what is the relation between the temperature and the density. From that, we can derive what the typical pressure of the gas in these systems. And then we can write the same equation that we wrote there, very simple, for isothermal gas, like assuming some relation between the temperature and the density. And this is now the new hydrostatic equilibrium equation, right? We solved that. And basically, that gives us the model for the objects in this simulation. And this is what happened. Basically, we now select one halo in the simulation, the same halo that you saw in the pictures before. We measure what is the acceleration profile of the dark matter halo. We measure this term here, gm over r squared, basically. We fit an NSW halo to that, which is the dashed line that is there. We assume the temperature density relation that we saw in the previous plot, and solve the equation, right? And this is what we get. So the black point that you see there are the particles from the simulation, the density that we measure in the simulation, and the dashed line that you see there, almost indistinguishable from the points, is the model that we get. It's perfect. The agreement is perfect. And this is the temperature profile as well that we get. Right? Again, the agreement is almost perfect. And this is your point, Simona, so this is the H1 mass. Now the H1 density profile that we get, these are the column densities, right? So we can now, if we know what is the density of the gas, we know we can assume something about the temperature of the gas because we know the temperature of the gas, then we can calculate what is the H1 mass that we expect for them.
So what is the difference between the black and the red and
the blue? The blue is H1. So this is the density of gas. This is the density of H1, the volumetric density, and this is the column density of H1.
Global column density in the 19, it's mostly get ionized.
That's why. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And these are very important predictions because if we know what the column density, we know the H1, the mass in H1, basically we can make predictions about the emission in 21 centimeters of these objects. And basically provide some guidance to the observers to say, oh, these are the characteristics, the features that you should see in these systems.
So have you actually calculated how many hours or
any? No. These are just to finish, so we have like 5 minutes only. This is just to convince you, basically applying this model. Now, if we know what is the halo mass, we know what is the gas mass, and then we can derive all these properties analytically and compare with observations, right? So these are different predictions for different halo masses or gas masses from very low to very high masses. I mean 10 to the 10, 10 to 9 in halo mass. And these are the density profile that we should observe. Because we know the density profile, we know the column density, we can estimate different sizes. For example, we can start playing with different sizes. For example, what is the radius of one isothermal, what is the radius of another isothermal, and things like that. And we start playing with these things, and this is what we see here. Basically, you see the analytic prediction that we see there basically agrees perfectly well with all the simulations, with the data that we get from the simulations. Anyway, just to finish, what are the main features of these objects? Now we can observe them, the ones that have gas, how they look like, right? So from the environmental segregation that they have, right? So we saw that basically the gas, the halos that have gas, basically are typically in the outskirts of the local group. That means they are really far away from us, typically farther than 1 megaparsec from us, right? 500 kiloparsec, 1 megaparsec, 2 megaparsecs from us. That means that they must be in the Hubble flow, right? That means that the recession velocity of these objects has to be mostly positive. These are the red ones. Current observation of high ultra-compact high-velocity clouds, observation in H1, in emission, basically shows are these objects that we see there, right? So basically, we see that basically these are observations, no? Of people that people have done in the past. Of I know everybody knows here was a high velocity cloud, ultra compact high velocity cloud. Basically, people do surveys in 21 centimeters emission, and they observe like spots in the sky that are bright in 21 centimeters. And sometimes they have a counterpart, an extra counterpart. Sometimes they don't. If they don't, we don't know where they are. So some people have speculated that those may be the dark halo that we're talking about here. But you see here that basically the characteristic of the features, basically the velocity, the red velocity of these clouds, basically is they are within a very broad range, right? So there are clouds that have very negative velocity, clouds with high relative velocity. Our prediction is that they should be mostly positive velocities. So basically we can rule out all these things from being this kind of object, dark matter halos. Likely, right? Also, they are really small. So this is a typical size of high-velocity clouds. This is a fraction of flux, right? So this is the typical size that people observe. And these are the typical size of these kind of objects. Also, there is a parameter, which is W50, which is a measurement of the broadening of the line, right, in the 21 centimeter. And basically, all these objects are in hydrostatic equilibrium. That means they don't have any turbulence. That means that basically the broadening should be consistent with the thermal broadening, right? With the temperature they have. So there should be a very defined typical value for them. Basically, they are mostly round, right? So if we basically, because they are in hydrostatic equilibrium, we are assuming they are round. This is the result of the simulation, if you want. Basically, the ratio between the major and the minor axis of this object should be roughly one, whereas the high-velocity clouds, you see, there is a broad range. So why these things were not observed yet? I don't know. Basically, our simulation, the typical distance that they have and the typical masses that they have, basically imposes a detection limit around here. Basically, the flux of this object should be smaller than the value that you see here. And this is just the detection limit of this surface. So we should push the surface to even lower higher sensitivities or lower fluxes to be able to observe them. According to our simulations. Mm-hmm. That's it, so I'll leave you with the conclusions. But basically, the main conclusion is the calculation is simple, can be done. The results agree very well with simulations. And we have strong predictions, right, of the property of these objects. We don't know anything about the clustering yet, because as you see, the environment basically can affect the numbers of these objects really matters. So where the environment where they are embedded really matters to calculate the fraction of them and to calculate the interactions, how many of those there are with gas and how many of those there are without gas. Basically, you need high resolution simulation because you need to be able to resolve basically the gas within these halos. That makes the problem computationally challenging, but in principle it can be done. Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Thanks. Any further questions or thoughts, comments?
No, what was my question? Oh, so you didn't say anything about the simulation. I suppose it's a full-blown cosmological simulation, the speed bag, everything, the whole shebang.
Mm-hmm. It's a zooming simulation of the local group from the Apostle project.
Okay. So these these relics, are supposed to be located in the sort of underdense, voidish regions. You actually go into the simulation. Do you find metals down there? In other words, have you checked what extent the metallicity of your relics are zero?
I checked that, yes, it's zero. For these relics, it's zero. That might be dependent on the model, how we inject metals in the simulation. Mm-hmm. But yes, for this simulation, it's zero. It's primordial,
But the gas that's surrounding them, because maybe the gas never got into them, but the gas around them in the voids, is that metal enhanced, or that's also still completely primordial?
I think mostly primordial. So we are 1 megaparsec farther outside from the local group, right?
But again, in most of these simulations, I mean, I always thought that the metals make their way out into the void very easily, very quickly.
They do have a couple of, you know, bigger radii from each galaxy. And so all that thick filaments that you saw, all that is put with the metals. But these are far from all those regions. That's why they still hang on to their gas. Because the gas is so weakly bound, as soon as it gets close to an overdense region, you just lose it to ground pressure surface. They're very far from any region where it comes, far as the region that could have polluted the metals. But you know, as I said, if, for example, the metal ejection was much stronger than we were assuming in these simulations, that might change. Any other questions or thoughts? If not, let's thank you.